Vicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vicatra AI. When you think about the texts that have, well, fundamentally shaped human civilization, law, morality, art, the daily lives of nearly 2 billion people, the Quran is right up there. It sits at this historical and cultural crossroads.
Yeah, it really does. Few other documents even come close.
But getting into a text that's so sacred, so historically dense, it can feel a bit overwhelming, can't it? Especially with all the noise out there today, the sound bites.
It absolutely is a challenge. And that's why today we're trying to cut through that. We're taking a deep dive into Michael Cook's work. He's a, well, a world-renowned scholar of Near Eastern studies. And his approach gives us a really clear, objective path into understanding this complex document. Our mission here is basically to give you a solid framework for understanding the Quran.
Not just as a rule book, though.
Exactly. Not as a simple rule book, but as this rich, layered, and frankly essential historical and literary artifact.
Precisely. This isn't really about debating theology. It's about intellectual honesty, getting the historical context right. If you want to be informed, you kind of need to understand this book. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the person guiding us here, Michael Cook. He's a professor at Princeton. What makes his approach, this sort of secular historical toolkit, so useful for the Quran?
Well, it's because the tool fits the job, you know. Cook is a rigorous academic historian. He doesn't come at the Quran with a preset religious agenda, either for or against Islam.
Okay.
He uses the exact same critical methods he'd use on, say, Roman imperial records or the earliest texts of Plato.
So he's looking at it primarily as a historical source.
Precisely. And that distance, that objectivity, is really helpful for you, the listener, because it helps filter out a lot of the static. Contemporary debates can get so politically charged or theologically driven. Cook lets us step back and ask, what did this text actually mean to the people hearing it back in 7th century Arabia? How did it function as a document then?
That makes a lot of sense. Clarity is the goal. And what's really interesting is his core idea, this methodological point, that we have to see the text in two dimensions at the same time.
Yes, that duality is crucial. It is a historical document, you know, rooted in a specific time and place, 7th century Arabia.
Right.
But it's also a living religious text.
Yeah.
It holds immense spiritual authority for billions today. You just can't grasp its cultural and political power if you try to pull those two apart. A historian has to respect the life it still has.
That dual view historical artifact, living text, that's a perfect way to think about the world it came from. We sometimes imagine 7th century Arabia as this, like, isolated pagan desert, right?
Yeah, that's a common misconception.
But Cook shows it as part of late antiquity, a vibrant, kind of messy crossroads. What was that world actually like?
Oh, it was absolutely saturated with religious ideas. You're talking about the edges of the Byzantine and Sasanian empires.
Yeah.
Arabian polytheism focused on the Kaaba was certainly there. But you also had well-established Jewish tribes, influential Christian communities, often different kinds, like Monophysite or Nestorian Christians, all around the Arabian Peninsula. It was an intellectually charged environment.
So the Quran didn't just drop into a vacuum. It landed right in the middle of this big ongoing conversation about monotheism.
Absolutely. And the text itself sees itself as being an active dialogue with those earlier traditions.
Mm-hmm.
It talks directly about biblical figures, you know, Abraham, Moses, Jesus. And interestingly, Mary gets a lot of attention.
Right.
But it offers new, distinct interpretations of their stories and roles.
So wait, how does that dialogue work? Is it saying we confirm the Bible or we replace it?
Well, it kind of does both. And that's the subtlety Cook points out. The Quran says it confirms the original pure monotheism started by Abraham, what it calls the fitra, this sort of innate human tendency towards one God. But at the same time, it claims to correct what it sees as human errors or distortions that crept into the texts and practices of Jews and Christians over time. So it presenting itself as an innovation within that broader Abrahamic tradition.
Okay, now here's where it gets really interesting, especially if you're picking up the Quran for the first time. The structure. It's famously nonlinear, doesn't read like Genesis, say, or the Gospels, moving chronologically. That must be quite confusing for a new reader.
It definitely presents a structural challenge. The Quran is divided into 114 chapters called surahs.
Surahs.
And those are made up of verses called ayahs. Now, except for the very first chapter, the Fatiha, they're mostly arranged in order of decreasing length.
Decreasing length. So you start with these really long chapters with lots of different topics, laws, stories, and you end up with the short, punchy, almost poetic ones.
Exactly. And that structure kind of forces you away from reading it as a linear story. It pushes you towards engaging with the themes, God's oneness, prophecy, judgment more holistically, as a unified message, regardless of when a specific part was revealed historically.
And that structure itself tells a story, right? About the community's journey. There's this crucial difference between the two types of suttas.
That's right. It lines up perfectly with the early Muslim community's history. You have the Meccan suttas, revealed earlier in Mecca when the community was small, often facing persecution.
Oh, okay.
These tend to be shorter, very rhythmic, really focused on the core theology, warnings about judgment, stories of earlier prophets, and the absolute oneness of God to heed.
And then the others.
Then you have the Medinan suttas. These came later, after the Prophet Muhammad and his followers moved to Medina and established the Ummah, the actual community state.
Right, when they started governing.
Exactly. So these are generally longer, a bit more like prose, and they contain the legal and social guidance, the basis of Sharia law needed to run a community.
Mm-hmm.
Rules about warfare, inheritance, family law, contracts, that kind of thing.
You can see the shift from a prophetic movement to a functioning society.
Precisely. The text reflects the community's changing needs and circumstances.
Let's pivot now to the absolute core theological message, the engine driving the whole thing, Tawhid, the absolute uncompromising oneness of God. Cook really hammers this home as the defining pillar.
It's the bedrock. Yeah. Everything else flows from it. God is unique, indivisible, all-powerful. The worst possible sin in this view is shirk, associating anything or anyone else with God's authority.
That sounds incredibly, well, transcendent, like a distant, powerful king.
Yeah.
But Cook also highlights this interesting tension, this duality in how God is portrayed. He's not just transcendent, is he?
No, and that tension is key to its power. He is the omnipotent creator, the judge, totally beyond human grasp in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the text constantly emphasizes he is also the merciful, the forgiving, the guide who is intimately close. There's that famous line about God being closer to man than his jugular vein.
Wow. So both incredibly powerful and incredibly near.
Exactly. Think of it like a cosmic ruler who's also your most immediate, compassionate listener. It inspires both awe, maybe even fear, but also deep love and reliance.
And what fuels the need to submit, to follow this guidance, is this constant focus on eschatological urgency, the end times, Judgment Day.
It's a huge rhetorical driver. The Quran constantly reminds its audience, the day of judgment is coming, it's inevitable. This isn't just philosophy, it's presented as an urgent reality.
How does it do that?
It uses incredibly vivid imagery, the joys of paradise, the torments of hell, very powerful contrasts designed to shake the listener awake, to call for immediate moral and social change. It's a call to action right now.
And that call wasn't just abstractly moral, it addressed specific problems in 7th century society, didn't it? Like economic issues.
Oh, absolutely. The text is a strong critique of the social situation in Mecca at the time. It condemns things like hoarding wealth, exploiting the poor, usury.
So it's laying down social principles, too.
Yes, foundational principles for building a just community, the Ummah, how to treat orphans, rules for inheritance, regulating family life, all aimed at creating a fairer society than what existed before.
Now, I have to talk about something believers often point to as proof the Quran is divine, the language itself. Cook discusses this unique Arabic style, saj, or rhymed prose. Why is the way it's written so important?
Because, for believers, the language is the miracle. It's not just what it says, but how it says it. It uses powerful rhetoric, striking oaths, and this unique rhythm that's designed for oral recitation. It has this incredible sonic impact.
So the beauty isn't just, like, decoration.
No, not at all. The literary power serves a theological purpose. It's meant to demonstrate its non-human divine origin. This is the concept of Ijaz, its inimitability. The idea is that no human could create something like it.
How did it compare to other writing at the time?
Well, Cook points out that 7th century Arabia had sophisticated poetry traditions. But the Quran's style was different. It wasn't quite poetry. It wasn't simple prose either. It felt unprecedented, this rhythmic, powerful proclamation.
Which brings us back to that classic warning for anyone reading it not in Arabic. A translation is just a shadow of the original.
Precisely. The power, the persuasive force, the sheer rhetorical beauty that inspires faith, so much of that is tied to the sound, the rhythm, the experience of hearing it in the original Arabic. A translation gives you the meaning, of course, which is vital.
But it misses that performative power.
Exactly. It can't capture the full effect of Ijaz.
Okay, moving from the text itself to its history.
Hmm.
How did we get from these revelations being spoken, maybe written down on scraps, to the single book read worldwide today, what does Cook say about how it was compiled?
Well, the traditional accounts, which are our main source for this early period, talk about oral transmission being key at first. Companions of the Prophet memorized the revelations, and they were collected on various materials, parchment, bones, palm leaves, whatever was available as the revelations came to an end. But then, as the early community expanded rapidly, and many of those who had memorized it started dying in battles,
they realized they needed a standard version.
Exactly. The need for standardization became urgent to prevent variations and loss.
And that leads to this really crucial moment that historians focus on, the Uthmanic recension.
Yes, the Uthmanic recension. This happened under the third caliph, Uthman. He commissioned a committee to compile a single, standardized canonical version of the text.
And then what?
Copies were made and sent out across the growing Islamic empire, and other variant versions were, according to tradition, destroyed. This process was absolutely critical. It settled early disputes about different ways of reciting or minor textual differences.
And cemented the text we have today.
Yes, it created the definitive text that Muslims universally read and recite now.
Okay, so bringing this all together, what does this all mean for us today? Cook gives us these great tools for analysis, the history, the structure. But why should someone, say, not specializing in Near Eastern history, care about these details in the 21st century?
Well, for starters, it's fundamental for cultural literacy and global understanding. Yeah. I mean, if you want to understand the history, law, politics, art, philosophy across huge parts of the world, the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, you really have to understand the source text that has shaped so much of that civilization.
Things like the concept of the Ummah, the community, or Sharia law.
It all starts here. Understanding those concepts, how they develop, their basis in the text, it's essential for understanding global affairs.
And it also helps with interfaith understanding, doesn't it? Cook's approach, clarifying how the Quran sees itself in relation to Judaism and Christianity.
Absolutely. Understanding that the Quran positions itself as both confirming and correcting earlier scriptures provides a much more informed basis for dialogue between these traditions. You understand where the connections and the divergences are coming from according to the text itself.
That makes sense.
And finally, it highlights this fascinating theme of unity and diversity in interpretation. The Uthmanic recension created a unified text, physically.
But the meaning isn't fixed.
Well, that's where the vast centuries-long tradition of tafsir, that's exegesis or commentary, comes in. It shows the text is constantly being interpreted, debated, applied.
So that tradition of tafsir is what keeps it a living text, right? It's not just an ancient document gathering dust.
It's incredibly dynamic. You see modern scholars engaging with this tradition constantly. Whether they're talking about science or gender roles or democracy or environmentalism, they're often doing it through interpreting the Quran, drawing on centuries of tafsir while also bringing new perspectives. It shows the text's meaning is always being negotiated.
What really struck me from Cook's analysis is that point about ijaz, the inimitability, the idea that the sound and the literary beauty are themselves the core proof of divinity. That's, well, it's a powerful concept, but maybe hard for someone from a different background, used to different kinds of evidence or narrative, to fully grasp.
It is a different way of thinking about sacredness and proof. And that really captures the essence of Cook's contribution, I think. He shows you can apply rigorous historical scholarship and still respect the profound spiritual significance a text holds for believers.
It's not either.
No. He argues the deepest understanding comes from holding both things in balance, its specific 7th century historical roots and its ongoing spiritual power and global relevance.
Okay, here's a final thought based on Cook's work. He argues the Quran sees itself as the culmination of the whole Abrahamic story, the final corrected chapter of God's message to humanity.
Mm-hmm. That's its self-perception.
So imagine if that perspective, that earlier scriptures are confirmed but then superseded or corrected by this final revelation, was widely accepted not just by Muslims, but within Jewish and Christian traditions too. How would that fundamentally change how those traditions teach their own origins and how they relate to each other today?
That's quite a thought experiment. It would certainly force a radical rethinking of some foundational narratives.
Something fascinating for you, our listener, to mull over. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.